Chapter 9.
I don't want to worry you, sir, but I've just heard something on the metal commodities market that might concern us. Someone's talking about offering futures in Mandalorian iron, and Mandal Motors shares are being snapped up for the first time in years.
Investment Analyst, Galactic Alliance Treasury. Mandal Motors Research Wing, Caldabe, Mandalore.
What do you think, then, Fett?
Jir Yomaget was the kind of man who probably had to be anesthetized to get him into a business suit. He stood with his arms folded, gazing rapt at an airframe that Fett hadn't seen before, an incongruously scruffy and disturbingly young man in dark green coveralls and partial armor.
Prototype?
Yomaget nodded.
Started life as the Kyrgalar. Up to 3 crew, or 2 with extra payload. Atmosphere capable, configurable for anything from planet pounding to hunter-killer roles, and fast. Now tell me it's not gorgeous.
Research wing was a flattering term for the collection of scruffy sheds and hangars, but the ramshackle appearance of the exterior belied the technology within. Mandal Motors had struggled to get back on its feet under a galactic alliance that wasn't handing out reconstruction grants to Mandalore. Now it had an edge it could exploit.
How fast?
Asked Fett. Yomaget probably didn't look at his wife and kids with as much adoration as he was lavishing on the assault fighter.
0.4 hyperdrive. The ultimate shock weapon.
And you never offered me the chance to purchase.
Fett had modified Slave 1 to a 0.7.
That beats an X-Wing.
Unfinished prototype.
It was about 15 meters nose to tail, with an 8-meter span. A faceted charcoal gray wedge of a ship that had none of the insectoid lines of the Star Viper. Fett walked around it, noting empty racks and housings, and took a guess that it would pack 4 laser cannons and maybe a couple of other weapons. The tail ended in a flat section with grills and vents that looked like the ports on a data pad. The skin was totally plain, its angled surfaces unbroken except for the Mythosaur logo picked out in a lighter gray on the side hatches. No bright work, no sharp-edged recesses, and the tinted transparasteel canopies seemed to merge into the superstructure. Fett would have ducked underneath it to take a look at the blaster pods and store pylons, but the fighter sat too low for him to do it comfortably. He couldn't face being gripped by pain and having to crawl out like an idiot.
So it's fast. And pretty.
Deflective stealth hull, cooled vents, scanner-absorbent coating.
Yomaget flourished a forearm plate attachment, tapped it, and the canopy popped. It parted into 2 top-hinged hatches, and he swung himself into the cockpit.
Also hinges from the lower edge, in case the pilot has to bang out. Now the avionics. Synthetic vision, panoramic cockpit display, eye-controlled switch selection, aiming. The works.
Sounds like you had a contest to see how many gizmos you could cram into one fighter.
All we've been able to do since the Vong War ended is reestablish our basic production models and work up some better ideas.
Yomaget leaned over the side of the fighter.
They all ended up in here.
So?
Well, you wanted to know what we might manufacture with the new Beskar. Personally, I'd be inclined to incorporate it into the airframe. Micronized Beskar skin, or laminate Beskar armor.
Bevin would call that over-egging the cake.
Think of this as the demonstrator.
That would make it the fastest, least vulnerable fighter on the market. The weapons load might be a compromise.
Fett wasn't sure if he had the power or right to tell Mandal Motors what to do with their product. This wasn't Coruscant, where national security overrode commercial concerns by law.
add the top-end armaments, though. And I wouldn't want that sold to anyone else.
Don't worry. We'll de-enrich the spec for export. We live here, remember? We all lost family to the Vong.
Yomaget jumped down from the cockpit with an agility Fett envied. Then he pressed the forearm plate attachment, and the fighter made a faint grinding sound before tilting back on its tail section and lifting through a full 90 degrees to sit upright, a mechanism not dissimilar to Slave One's.
It can land vertically in a footprint of a little over 32 square meters.
Fett walked a few meters away to get a better idea of the shape. It didn't look like any other vessel he'd seen.
I bet it does tricks, too.
Our shares have rocketed, and we haven't even unveiled this.
I bought a few. Someone had to make sure the majority shareholding stayed in Mandalorian hands.
Just as well we don't have a law against insider dealing.
I don't intend to sell. Might sign them over to someone on the condition they never sell on to Arue Tise.
Is that a go-ahead for production?
Full spec for us. De-enriched for them.
Fett walked away briskly, feeling his unconnected acts of prudence falling together into a policy of sorts.
Make sure the export hyperdrive spec is a fraction better than an X-Wing. No more.
Yomaget trailed after him. This was defense policy on the fly, and the clans didn't get consulted. And they wouldn't care, Fett knew.
We're going to arm the Confederation, then, said Yomaget.
We'll arm anybody, including the GA, if they can pay.
Fett hadn't even thought about the next move. It just happened.
Provided Colonel Jason Solo comes here in person to negotiate the deal.
You're a subtle man, Fett.
I've never been called that before.
50% of production for our own defense?
Defense.
That was one word for it.
Agreed.
Mandalorians liked a sensible compromise. The best deals were where both sides were happy, or where one was happy and the other dead. Fett stopped short of asking to fly the first Beskar fighter off the production line. He wanted that privilege to go to Bevin, the nearest he would ever have to a friend. He looked forward to seeing the reaction when Mandal Motors opened their order book. Jason Solo would have the choice between letting the GA's enemy buy better fighters than his and showing up here. Fett had no doubt which he'd choose, but it would be fun seeing him have to handle the messy presentational issues in public. That could be arranged.
It'll be called the Besulik, Yomaget called after him. The Basilisk. I always had a soft spot for the ancient battle droids. Good old Mondo name and old-fashioned Mondo iron in a state-of-the-art package.
Fett nodded to himself.
Besulik.
It had a nice ring to it. A name from the past. A name that wouldn't go away, however hard the rest of the galaxy tried to make it. Ever.
Besulik.
It was the kind of news that made other men walk away whistling. Charby Spaceport, Vulptor, Deep Core. Ben pressed as close to the viewport as he could to peer at the permacrete below. It was hazy daylight outside, but his body said it was still last night and he needed more sleep. As far as the rest of the spaceport was concerned, the well-maintained but very old Incom Tourer was not a Galactic Alliance guard ship carefully contaminated with Corellian dust, Corellian food waste, Corellian fabric, and any number of other touches designed to show a forensics team that the vessel definitely came from Corellia. And the battered intersystem delivery cutter tailing Cal Omis's shuttle wasn't a spy vessel with top-of-the-line comms, spoofing devices, and an overpowered hyperdrive. Jory LeCalf wasn't a GAG assassin either. He was just a nice, ordinary young Corellian on an adventure with his younger cousin in an elderly ship he'd saved every spare credit for a couple of years to buy. The trouble was that Ben could believe that all too easily, even though he'd seen the range of weapons LeCalf carried under his jacket.
"If I'd kept my hair red, the family resemblance would have looked more convincing," Ben said.
He wanted another calf to keep him alert, but he had a vision of being desperate to visit the refreshers at a critical point in the operation if he drank any more.
"Your hair's reddish, really."
"More sandy blonde," LeCalf said. "One red-headed human is noticeable, but two is asking to be remembered by witnesses. If we have any, that is.
Could have dressed as Ubizi. With masks.
I think that's been done before.
I'm just worrying."
"I know."
It was a long wait. Shevu would make contact with them when he landed. His last transmission said he was a few minutes behind Omis's shuttle, which wouldn't attract suspicion. Charby was a busy port, freighting cheap and shoddy goods, and ships landed almost too close together for safety and comfort. Nobody cared who you were, as long as port fees and taxes were paid. They said Vulptor had once been a lovely planet. It didn't look lovely now. The skies had that polluted, smoky haze that meant there were wonderful red sunsets here, and not much else to be grateful for. And this was after they'd tried to clean up the environment. The vast landing strip, landing field more like, was scattered with dozens upon dozens of craft in varying stages of disrepair, some taking on board supplies and fuel, some berthing next to freight warehouses where conveyor belts disgorged crates into their holds. Their outlines shimmered in the heat haze from idling drives, and there were all kinds of species wandering around on foot between the vessels, stretching their legs. Anywhere between one pair and four of them, it seemed. The only concession to landing field safety was a tracery of red and white painted lines across the permacrete bearing the warnings, "Pedestrians do not cross this line," and "Beware ground traffic." But everyone was crossing the lines as they pleased, and battered speeders with Charby Port Authority livery swerved around them, honking in annoyance. Ben decided it was the last place anyone would expect two heads of state to conduct a top-level meeting. "Stand by," LeCalf said quietly, pressing his fingertip to his ear. "It's the captain."
"Yes, sir."
"Copy that." He looked up. About 12 minutes before Omis lands, Shevu's right behind him in the landing queue. Ben perked up. The Karpaki was folded in two inside his jacket, right on the limit of what he could hide, and the vibroblade was tucked in his hip pocket. He'd rehearsed it all in his mind on a continuous loop of what-ifs and if-onlys. Rifle to drop Gedgen, preferably at very long range, and vibroblade to escape if seized. It would have been better to get Gedgen as the man disembarked, while he was exposed on the landing field for a few moments without bystanders milling around. But Jason wanted the meeting recorded. It was a case of following Gedgen, or Omis, to the room they'd hired by the hour, then slipping a strip cam through a gap under the doors. The building blueprints showed plenty of places to insert the flimsy thin device. Each room's doors were set in a recess, so, for once, it was a simple matter of squatting down as if picking up a piece of litter and shoving the strip cam into the gap.
"Should have put a hidden bug in Omis's coat or folio or something," LeCalf muttered. "Then we sit here, pinpoint Gedgen's ship, and slot him on the ramp as he leaves.
Ben fidgeted with the vibroblade, wondering how his mother would have tackled a job like this.
You can't stick bugs on people without them finding out sooner or later.
Yeah, with our luck he'd have changed his jacket. They used to have this stuff called tracking dust, you know, just like powder. If the target inhaled it, you could pick up signals from it for ages afterward.
Makes you wonder how much all this stuff costs, said Ben. I mean, we're dirt cheap, but we have to abandon this ship.
It's an old crate. Saves the Defense Department the cost of disposal.
And leaving it behind would add weight to the setup that Corellian dissidents had killed their own Prime Minister for giving in to the GA. That was the plan, anyway.
Ben switched seats in the cramped interior to look out from the starboard side.
Gedgen's ship should have landed by now, according to its flight plan. One pilot, three passengers, maximum 5-hour stopover. That was what it said on the CPA information database that his datapad, scrubbed of all identity in case of capture, showed him. Ben avoided looking at the chrono on the bulkhead. He just waited for the word from LeCalf.
"So how do you feel being an officer now?"
Ben asked.
"Weird. But my granddad would have been so proud. I wish he'd been alive to see it."
LeCalf never mentioned his parents. It was always his grandfather. It struck Ben that almost everyone he'd grown up with or worked with either had no family or had key members missing or totally absent. It wasn't normal. He thought about how routine killing was for his whole family, and knew that most of the beings in the galaxy got through their entire lives without ever killing anyone, deliberately or accidentally. It was strange that families like his got to make the really big decisions for worlds of normal, ordinary, non-lethal people. Ben concentrated on centering himself, edging a little toward that state where he vanished from the Force. He pulled himself back just as he felt a drifting sensation that could have been disappearance, or nodding off.
"Plug yourself in," LeCalf whispered. "It's a go."
Ben activated his comlink and earpiece, and shut down the environmental controls to leave the tourer. When LeCalf opened the hatch, the air and noise hit Ben like a solid wall. It smelled of factories and sulfur. They ambled down the ramp, working hard at looking ordinary, and made their way toward the terminal buildings as if they were killing time, not politicians. LeCalf scratched his ear, repositioning the earpiece.
"Got you, sir. Position?"
Ben picked up Chevu's voice clearly. "He'll pass 30 meters to the left of you unless he deviates. Heading for Building G. You pick him up, and I'll follow you in."
"No visual on the target yet."
"He must be inside already."
"Oh, this is real. This is happening."
It was a throwback of a thought, back to the time when Ben first started taking crazy risks. But this mission had an extra dose of risk. Omis knew him by sight, and had even met Chevu, too. They couldn't afford to be spotted. Ben slouched and meandered, as 14-year-old boys were prone to do, turning around from time to time to chat to LeCalf about safe and meaningless trivia. Baccarat, speeders, anything, while he took a cautious look across the permacrete in Omis's direction. And there he was, flanked by two men in working clothes, a carefully scruffy figure himself. His confident bearing gave him away as a man used to being obeyed, but only to someone who knew what he was looking for. And Ben did.
"Going okay," LeCalf whispered, not looking toward the three men.
One of the GA intelligence agents walked through the doors of Building G in front of Omis. The other followed close enough to tread on his heels. They almost vanished in the crowds inside the terminal building. but Ben kept them in sight, even though he lost LeCalf for a few moments. One of them appeared to be checking the numbers on various doors and exits as he walked, and eventually he stopped at one marked 53L and inserted a credit chip in the slot to one side. The doors parted, and Ben got a glimpse of a small, brightly lit room, almost filled by a white Duraplast table ringed by chairs. There was already someone in there. The doors closed again. A steady two-way river of passengers, port workers, flight crew, and the general temporary population of a spaceport stood between Ben and the doors.
"You can do this," LeCalf said. "How many in there? I can't place the strip cam under the doors if someone else is going to come along and open them again."
Ben closed his eyes and concentrated on the ebb and flow of the force, the patterns of density that he could both feel at the roof of his mouth and see as speckled color behind his eyelids.
"Six," he said. That made sense.
Two close protection agents each. Even numbers. Two statesmen who didn't trust each other.
"Yes, six. They're all inside now."
"Can you see lottery numbers, too?"
LeCalf made his way casually through the shoals of people and squatted down to adjust his boot. Ben saw him take out what looked like a small flimsy strip, then slide the thing under the hairline gap with quick ease. Strip cams were very small these days, the size of a coat check stub. They really were flimsy, and just as disposable once they'd finished transmitting.
"Lovely," said Chavu's voice in Ben's ear. "I can see right up Gedgen's nose. Good, clear sound. Nice job, Jory."
Eventually, Ben glanced around and spotted Chavu leaning against a drinks dispenser on the other side of the concourse. He was recording the output from the strip cam and transmitting it back to GAGHQ. As soon as he had confirmation that it had been received and stored, he'd erase his datapad and send a code to the strip cam to shred its data. It'd be just a scrap of garbage the cleaners would sweep up if they ever came this way. It looked as if they wouldn't. Ben and LeCalf could hear the conversation in their earpieces, both of them monitoring it so they knew when to vanish, wait for Gedgen to emerge, and follow him. It was a fascinating conversation. Ben had started to get the hang of the code and insinuation that beings in power used to say unpleasant things. A different language that let them deny later that they'd meant any harm. Jason was good at it. Ben hoped he never would be, because it got to be a habit, and Jason seemed to enjoy playing that game for its own sake. He recognized Omis's voice. Gedgen sounded softer than he did on the HNE bulletins. It was very weird to listen to a man you were about to kill. Ben was hearing the last words Der Gedgen would ever speak.
"So, can we agree as gentle beings to cease hostilities while we sort out a compromise? Before or after I take this to the Senate?" Omis asked. "I'm not referring this to my assembly. Yet. You might not need to refer it to yours,"
Gedgen replied.
"We'll stand down if you agree to that form of revised wording in the commitment of planetary defense assets to the GA. You might be able to deliver that with Corellian forces, but can you pull back the Bothans? Are you sure Neothel will do as you tell her? She's a career officer. She will. The Bothans are pragmatists. They will. As a show of goodwill, you'll commit forces to helping us restore order in places like the Sepan system. Of course. And you need us to come back into the GA fold to stop the membership hemorrhaging away.
I won't ask for any statement that causes loss of face. I know how proud Corellians are. Just something along the lines of differences being bridgeable.
That's very gracious, Chief Omis. Now, those differences will only be bridged if Admiral Neothel and Colonel Solo no longer carry the military weight that they do now.
You want me to fire them?
I think you might need to do more than fire them, now that they've become used to getting their own way.
I think I know what you mean, and I don't care for that solution.
Neothel, ambitious, dangerous, Solo, ambitious, dangerous, and Jedi, too. We can solve the problem for you permanently.
If you do, I don't need to know about it.
If we do, I'd like your security services to look the other way. Solo has ambitious minions who'd be temporarily blind and deaf in exchange for promotion, I think.
I see you know of Captain Gyrdon, then.
And they laughed. The two of them actually laughed. Ben heard a faint sound as if Shevu was clearing his throat. When Ben turned his head, LeCalf was looking at him. For once, not the permanently cheerful man who looked so much younger than he was. He looked old and angry.
"That's how much we're worth," he said quietly. "I bet our intel guys in there love the idea of having their man back in command."
Ben's gut turned suddenly heavy and cold. It was a dirty game all the way to the top. While he was preparing to assassinate Gedgen, Gedgen was doing a deal to strike at Jason and Neothel, with Omis turning a blind eye. Everyone could be bought if the price was high enough. Omis obviously put peace above individual lives. It might not have been any different in the long run from any general risking combat casualties, but it didn't feel anywhere near as clean. Ben switched his attention. He began to visualize the exterior of the terminal buildings. A walkway ran along the roof, a little-used observation deck where anyone could sit and watch vessels taking off and landing. It wasn't a popular spot, but it was perfect for a sniper. As soon as the meeting sounded as if it was coming to an end, Ben had a minute or two to get up on that roof and wait for Gedgen to exit. There were three sets of doors Gedgen could leave through to walk back onto the landing field and rejoin his ship. To cover that span, a couple of hundred meters, Ben would have to be ready to sprint along that platform in either direction from a central point.
"I'm ready."
He pressed his arm against his side and felt the Karpaki. It would be almost completely silent. He'd also be standing on top of a stark permacrete platform with no cover.
"I'll just have to be fast, then."
The conversation between Omis and Gedgen slowed, and there were longer pauses and more restless grunts and sighs. Business was drawing to a close. At a nudge from LeCalf, Ben began walking to the roof turbolift without even looking back. He stood in the turbolift cab with a family of Triani looking for a tap calf, wondering if they could smell his intentions. One of the GAG troopers liked free-falling. He'd told Ben that to jump off a 5,000-meter building, there was a point where a free-faller had to simply stop working up to it and step off into the void. Ben was at that point now, as he walked along the rooftop terrace and took up position. He stepped back into the shadow of a single, lonely air-conditioning outflow and unfolded the Karpaki. If he held it against the leg of his baggy, creased pants, It didn't present such an obvious profile. There was nobody around anyway. The observation platform was cracked, and weeds were thriving in the crevices. He settled down to wait for Chevu and Lecauf to do the spotting for him. Jason's going to go crazy when he hears what Omas has in mind for him.
Ben, heads up.
It was Chevu.
Gedgen's on the move. He's exiting via the south doors. Go right.
Ben checked around him and jogged to the far end of the platform, keeping close to the rear wall. He hoped he'd recognize Gedgen. He'd studied the man's face and walk intently before the mission. But now he might be looking at the back of his head, depending on the exact path he took back to the ship. It was a silly, petty doubt. He hadn't thought it through enough before he embarked. But when he looked down on the Permacrete and the chaos of ships, freight droids, and species of all kinds wandering around as if it were a theme park, that neat military haircut, jet black, glossy, not a strand out of place, drew his eye like a beacon. He lay prone and sighted up. The optics brought him instantly 100 meters closer to Durgedgen, and then there was no doubt that he had the right man in his crosswires. As Gedgen walked, two security guards in discreet casual clothes weaved in and out of Ben's shot. As soon as Gedgen dropped, at least one of them would be looking for where the shot had originated. Ben would have to stay low and melt back into the crowds in the airside terminal, then rendezvous with Lecauf at Chevu's transport.
I can do it. I got in and out of center point, didn't I?
Ben held his breath, let the Karpaki's smart optics adjust for wind and angle, and felt his finger tighten on the trigger. 1 second, Gedgen's neat dark head was filling the scope, and the next, Ben was staring at empty Permacrete as the rifle kicked back against his shoulder. The muffled report seemed to come from a long way away. Nothing seemed to have gone down in the order he expected. Shot, recoil, drop. He lay flat.
What happened? Did I kill him?
He could hear shouts carried on the air from 3 stories below. His body made the decisions for him, and he found himself scrambling backward to the rear wall, while Chevu's voice in his ear kept saying, "Get out of there, Ben!" He ran at a crouch to the turbo lift, found that it was on a lower floor, and took the fire escape stairway. It was going to plan. He could merge into the crowd. Back on the ground floor, he slipped through the fire doors and made a conscious effort not to look panicked. Maybe professional assassins could take this in their stride, but he couldn't. He'd put aside the fact that he'd just killed a man and found he was totally caught up in the simple act of getting away. When Chevu put his hand on his shoulder from behind, Ben thought he was going to have a heart attack.
"Keep walking," Chevu whispered.
Curious crowds were gathering at the transparasteel doors to gawp at the unfolding drama on the landing strip, and security staff were struggling to get through the crowd.
"Just keep on walking."
If they sealed the doors, it was chaos. Nobody seemed to know what had happened yet. That bought Ben, Chevu, and Lecauf a few more minutes. Charby seemed the kind of place where passengers and freighter captains would walk right past a dead body if it meant their flight left on time. They were counting on it.
"I'm right behind you," said Lecauf's voice in his earpiece. "If we walk down to the south doors, we can just go around the perimeter to Chevu's shuttle."
Ben was scared. He was happy to admit it. He hadn't been afraid at all on Centerpoint, but now he knew better. He kept a little distance between him and Chevu, remembering to pause every so often and look at the commotion as if he were genuinely curious about what was happening. But he carried on walking. Above him, the holoscreen that usually showed arrivals and departures was turned over to the traffic control tower's view of the landing strip. Yes. He'd killed Gedgen. A textbook headshot.
I can't feel my face. My lips feel numb.
Now Ben was seconds away from those doors, walking with the steady but thinning stream of droids, repulsor lifts, and passengers heading out to the vessels.
Nearly there.
He was a few meters away from the transparasteel doors when he saw a man in familiar casual clothes running at full tilt toward them. The doors parted, and Ben was staring down the muzzle of a blaster.
"Armed officer, CSA!"
the man barked.
"Everybody, stay where you are!"
Ben balanced on a blade's edge between surrender and making a run for it.